Gather round, children, listen. Let me tell you a story about a village that is built with his glory. No sorrow in this place. Just lift your voice and say, let's celebrate. Look like it's gonna be a lovely day. Come on, everybody, let's celebrate. Forget the worries, throw your problems away. Come on, everybody, let's celebrate.
Show your smile now.
Everybody, let's celebrate.
Welcome to the Village Celebration Podcast. Another police shooting, another hashtag, Terrence Crutcher. Video shows Crutcher's SUV stalled in the middle of a highway. He walks toward it with his hands in the air, and suddenly he falls to the ground, shot dead by Officer Betty Shelby. We've all seen the video. Meanwhile, in Charlotte, North Carolina, a man shot and killed by police. Police say Keith Scott had a gun. Family members say he had a book. Protesters have rallied in Charlotte, and all around America, we are asking ourselves, when will this end? When did the police start killing African Americans and getting away with it? The consensus of many is that this is nothing new. Joining us with a historical perspective on the police and the black community is sociologist Veronica Newton. Veronica, thank you for joining us.
Yes, no problem. Glad to be here.
Let's talk about the police and the African American community. There's so much distrust at this point. I think a lot of us are asking, when did this start?
Right. There's so many questions so many things and issues, right, that are constantly coming up with these police killings. And so from a historical perspective, which is I always like to take when looking at social issues such as police brutality, right, we have to go back to the origins. We cannot forget the historical context in which all these situations are set in. So when we think about the development of police departments, the police departments really did not come to be until post-emancipation. Policing in the North and in the South were very different. So in the North, where there really wasn't much slavery happening, right, it wasn't the typical antebellum Southern plantation style of slavery. So in the North, there would have different sheriffs, small units of policing. There'd be community members that would help police just certain crimes, small infractions, right? However, in the South was a completely different story. There weren't police officers. There may have been a sheriff for a town here and there to, like I mentioned, to help diffuse certain small situations. But policing as we know it started with slave hunters. And slave hunters were the people who were hired by slave-holding white men to capture or to recapture or to catch slaves who attempted to run away, right? And this was their actual term. They were slave hunters. They had a badge, and they had guns, and they had weapons, as well as bloodhounds to chase and seek after enslaved blacks who attempted to escape to the North for freedom. This is important because this idea of having authority and having a badge and having social control over black individuals stems from plantation owners and slave hunters, right?
So let me just ask you right there, this idea of a license to do as one pleases dates back many, many, many years, because that's what we hear a lot, and that's what we're seeing in these videos. It seems as if the police feel they can do as they please.
Yes, it's that discretion, right? It's that discretion to control certain bodies, right? And those bodies have always been black bodies. There's always been a structural control for a social control to control black bodies moving throughout the spaces within the United States. And so the slave hunters had all discretion, had all the power, and would have networks, right, into being able to try to catch or recapture blacks. Even when blacks did travel and make it to the North, there was still that social capital, there was still that social connection that slave hunters had with different officers and other, you know, white individuals, white male individuals in particular at that time, to whether it was write letter to say, well, there's someone who looks like that, maybe you're enslaved black, so I'm going to have them transport it back to you, right? So there's always a conjunction and a connection between the different states, right? Which is why we see police brutality popping up across the nation, right? It's not like it's just in one isolated city, right? It's not like it's just Ferguson, Missouri. It's in every city. It's in Baltimore. It's in North Carolina. It's in California, right? And so that police culture has transgressed just not just from being in the South, but also being in the North. And that really happened post-emancipation when we have the great migration of blacks moving to northern cities, right? We also had an influx of European immigrants coming in, and there was more crime rates happening because of lack of housing and lack of resources, right? And so people were blaming these new people in these new northern cities with, you know, they're blaming crime on them, right? And so these police strategies that were utilized within the South to help control blacks and to control where they lived, control what they did, who they hung out with, were utilized within the police forces, right? So this is when we see a development of police departments utilizing these same social control tactics that were utilized by slave hunters during the antebellum South.
So it's almost as if this police culture that we see today is a part of the DNA of the authority structure that's used to police, as you're saying, black bodies. So it's only morphed a little bit. It's adjusted to the times.
Right, because when we think about the transition of race as a social concept, right, it's not really acceptable for institutions and just Americans in general. We'll exclude this Trump phenomenon, but to be overtly racist, right, versus it was during the antebellum South, to create that difference between blacks and whites in America and to give legal ground into controlling black bodies. Now, that's a little bit less acceptable, especially when you look at the justice system, and it tries to present itself as a source that you know, is equality for all. We know for a fact that it's not, right? And so I think it's really interesting when people say, well, they're just police officers, they're just doing their job. Well, their jobs derive from, you know, slave hunters and controlling black bodies. And so that's a very important piece that we can't, you know, overlook within our society today, because we see kind of the phenomenon, the effect of the overt racism being played out today with police officers and racial profiling and police brutality.
And you call it the Trump phenomenon. It raises this question to me. Which came first, the chicken or the egg, this overt racism or the Trump phenomenon?
I think that from a sociological perspective, Donald Trump is a product of America. It's a product of the historical and foundational systemic social inequalities that are embedded within our justice system. They're embedded in our Constitution. They're embedded throughout the jurisprudence within our society. And there's no way we can really escape that. Unless we really do a lot of work in rewriting constitutions, rewriting policies, coming up with a list of demands that we need the federal government to address to reduce police brutality. There's no reason why a police officer who's carrying around a gun should be afraid of black and brown bodies, right? If you're afraid of black and brown bodies, perhaps you shouldn't be in a field that you have lethal force to, you know, kill someone. And so there's a lot of different things, I think, that can be done. However, we can't divorce the fact that, you know, policing as we know today derived from slave hunters. That's something that will not ever change, and we can't change history. So Donald Trump is kind of the product of all of these moving pieces together of racism and institutionalization of racism, really, that we've seen throughout our history of America.
And to your point, it would take an awful lot of work, and work on more than just the part of black Americans. There has to be an awakening in white America and an understanding that we need whole-scale changes in the justice system and in so many of the social institutions that we just accept as they are currently. But this is no longer going to work.
Correct. I think that another piece of that is learning the history, right? Like, when you think about the police brutality that really erupted, you know, during the times of lynching, during the Civil Rights Movement, during the Black Power Movement, right? Mm-hmm. There was the Deacons for Defense decided to police the police, right, to try to diminish police brutality. Then you move to the 80s. There was this war on drug where there was an infiltration of the federal government using police aid to over-police, right, black and brown areas. And then in the past 20 years, there's been the militarization of the police, right? So it's almost getting worse in the sense
Absolutely.
That there's more legitimation into police officers having discretion. There's war tactics being used, and there's, you know, inhumane tactics being used, according to the United Nations, that are being used within the United States against marginalized populations such as Native Americans, such as Latino populations, as well as black populations. So in order for us to move forward, we do have to learn this history and to be aware of what's going on, what has happened before, so we don't repeat the same mistakes.
It is stunning, the disregard for black bodies that we are seeing today. And I believe that it is more than just we're capturing it on video. What are your thoughts?
We've seen, video, police officers wearing body cams is not going to solve a thing, right? Mm-hmm. A prime example of that would be Rodney King, right? There was literally, you know, video of him being beaten, right? And the officers were still acquitted. Video cameras are not the silver bullet. Mm-hmm. I don't think there is a silver bullet. I do think that limiting police officers' discretion could help. More cultural training. We need to have police officers who obtain college degrees, and so they can take sociological classes, they can take cultural competency classes, they can take history classes, right? Just to have a broader worldview and a world perspective on people who are different than them. Mm-hmm. I think that can go across the board with learning different cultures, whether it's Native culture or Latino culture or Black cultures, which are often not valued or often different than those who are in power, but having that cultural competency is very important, right? Mm-hmm. So there's lots of different things that can be done on state and federal levels that are not done, and to kind of go off on that a little bit. We look at similar nations such as, like, for England, for an example. Mm-hmm. Their police officers don't carry guns, right? And so we have to look at other nations who are comparable to the United States and see what strategies they're using to police crime. Because right now we have an over-policing of black and brown bodies and under-policing of issues that are really pertinent to our society that deal with social problems, right, mm-hmm. on a daily basis within neighborhoods. So we kind of have to find a cure for that over-policing, under-policing, and find a way for just policing to happen, because they're there to protect and serve, correct?
They are.
And right now, they're not protecting and serving black and brown and Native communities at all.
That's so very true. You know, to even broach the idea of police without guns would strike at the heart of the whole gun control issue in America, which is a different battle, which I also feel is tied to race and racism in America.
Yes, exactly. There's plenty of articles out there from different historians, different sociologists who discuss the link the Second Amendment, your Second Amendment right mm-hmm. to bear arms, with racism, right? Mm-hmm. This idea of protecting and serving was really only, that idea derived during enslavement, because it was really only to protect and serve property-owning white men, right? And so property was whether they owned a plantation and owned individual, they owned people. That's why that property piece is so important, because it was to protect and preserve the property rights. Because during that time, property rights were utilized as civil rights, and you could vote and things like that. And so we really have to look at the foundation of these policies and these amendments and which they derive from, right? And
right.
So there always is going to be a racial aspect to be able to protect your own land, right? That's the idea, that to protect your land and your own property. And so there's always a racial aspect underlining, or whether it's more covert or more overt, it's there. It's always there. And that's kind of a large pill for many people to swallow.
It is.
They want, you know, this colorblind agenda oftentimes, but we really have to look at the legislation that's being passed, who it's affecting the most, who are the decision makers in that, and where are going to be the outcomes for most of us, right? And oftentimes when it's you're a part of a community that is marginalized, whether you're Black, Latino, or Native, the consequences may not, are probably not going to benefit you the most. And so this is why we need a list of demands, so to speak, for federal change and policymaking, as well as policymaking in regards to guns, as in regards to policing, racial profiling, brutality. I mean, the list really could go on.
And it takes us right back to your point that in order for us to see changes, we need to have, there's a lot of work involved. But it's hard to get that work done when more than half of the population simply is not comfortable having a discussion about the primary underlying issue, and that is race.
Yep.
That's
yep.
the starting
it all
point.
It all goes back to race. Mm-hmm. Race and racism are always sensitive topics for quite a few Americans.
Mm-hmm. Sociologist Veronica Newton joining us for the Village Celebration. Thank you so much for your thoughts. We always appreciate them. And we'll be back in a moment.
Hey, business owners and entrepreneurs, our illustrious leader, J.C. Love, is so excited. He's put together a fifth anniversary advertising package just for your business. Me, personally, I think he's lost his ever-loving mind. Here's what you get.
JC
3 months of advertising. 3 times per day, Monday through Friday, and we throw in weekends just for kicks. We blast your business on the Joinet Radio social media network. Live mentions on the air. You get not one, not two, but 3 live interviews throughout the duration of the ad cycle. That's a $1,200 value. This total package is only $375. That's right, $375. Business owners, get to the phones right now. Call 855-525-5683 for the next 3 months. JoinEdRadio.com is celebrating its 5th year anniversary, and the savings are being passed on to you.
You don't have to play sports to be a champion. On or off the field, each day, you dedicate time and effort to reach your personal goals and dreams. But tobacco use can ruin your hard work and path to higher achievement. If you use tobacco, make a play that brings you one step closer to victory and better health. Call the Arkansas Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW to speak with a quit counselor about free medication and support. It's time to feel like the champion you are.
Slow credit, bad credit, no problem. Butler Furniture Depot has a no credit check purchase plan with 90 days same as cash to qualify. 1 month on the job with a $1,200 a month income and have an active checking account. Congratulations, you're approved. Go by one of our 3 locations in Little Rock, North Little Rock, or Conway and take advantage of some of our super saving outstanding deals.
Who done it? The butler done it. Butler Furniture Depot.
Recent studies have shown that diabetes can be prevented, and the results are even greater with my patients over age 60. Losing a small amount of weight by getting some physical activity, 30 minutes, 5 days a week, and eating healthier has proven to be effective. Listen to the great results from one of my patients.
I had to learn how to change my way of eating because diabetes ran in my family, and I wanted to take control of it before I got it.
Having diabetes in your family and being overweight puts you at a higher risk for type 2 diabetes. These risks increase with age, which is why it is important to take your first step today.
There was a time I could not go from my basement up to my bedroom, but now I can, and that means a lot to me.
It's not too late to prevent diabetes. Join my patients who are taking small steps and gaining big rewards.
For more information on how to prevent type 2 diabetes, call 1-800-438-5383. This is a message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the National Diabetes Education Program.
Dave Coleman here for the Weekly Sports Magazine. In the 1968 Olympics, 2 young black men decided to stand and tell the world what America says is not what America believes. One of those men, Dr. John Carlos joins us this Saturday morning. We'll get his thoughts on Colin Kaepernick and the growing wave of black protests that's sweeping the country in our athletic events. Saturday morning at 8 on the Weekly Sports Magazine on JoinetRadio.com.
Welcome back to the Village Celebration Podcast. We are talking tonight about yet another killing of a black man by police. At least two killings in the past week. One caught on video. Comedian Cheryl Underwood, who is also one of the co-hosts of the show The Talk, moved to tears by the extreme police brutality we are seeing these days. Listen.
What do you think it'll take to stop racial profiling?
Well, I mean, I wish any of us could answer that question, right? This is like a new low to me. It's so disheartening that he didn't have a weapon, he didn't have any drugs, he didn't have any behavior that was alarming, his arms were up. I don't understand. There was like practically seven police officers there or something. Why this officer could have interpreted this as a threat is so beyond me. I mean, I don't know if maybe we... Too often there is paid leave. I don't know if it needs to be, you know, prosecuting when someone uses such poor judgment like this. I mean, that's the only thing I can
trust. I think there are two things to think about, which is, first of all, as you said, he was complying. He was tasered. You can't tell from these videos, but what it seems like, and this is allegedly, is that he was actually shot when he was already on the ground, which is really alarming.
Oh. Ooh.
We also remember a recent case, and I don't have the names, I think it was in Florida, of a guy who was a therapist working with a guy with autism.
Yes. Yes.
He's on
yes.
the ground,
yes.
on his
yes.
back with his arms
yes.
raised,
yes.
and they shoot him anyway.
Yes.
And when he asked the cop, why you shoot me, the cop said, I don't know.
Right.
So what we have is, look, this is hard to talk about. This is hard stuff to talk about. But we have a legacy of racism in this country. And if we don't start calling it racism, then we can't fight it.
That's
we
right.
have to see what it is. Cops have to be trained differently. If this had been...
You don't have to train the police not to shoot white people. Why you got to train them not to shoot us?
But, Davy, I'm saying everything has to be confronted. Everything has to be confronted. Because when you see a high speed... There was a high speed chase recently in L.A. with a Caucasian woman. She went through several counties. She ran into cars. She ran up on the road. When they took her out of the car, they gently removed what looked like a cell phone and gently handcuffed her. If that had been a black man, he would have been face down on the pavement
right.
without 1 second of conversation. We have to change how we see each other. And we
That's
cannot
true.
Do that until we say what it is, which is that racism and fear of black men specifically drives these shootings. We have to change as a nation.
Look, but
fundamentally.
But I know we gotta go to break, but first thing you gotta do, you gotta make it a hate crime. You gotta make it, you gotta put people
you've
in jail.
Prosecute
when you
these
shoot
crimes.
Somebody under the color of authority, you need to lose your job, and you need to lose your livelihood, and you need to lose your freedom. Like every other American loses
yes.
their freedom.
Exactly. Consequences.
That's
need
right.
Consequences.
Need to be consequences. But remember, there are good police
are.
Officers out there. And the ones that are not, they need to go to jail.
Yeah.
They need to go to jail. And don't tell me this. We got to train. Y'all white. Y'all drive all the time and don't nothing happen to y'all. And we black. And I'm afraid to drive my damn car because if they don't know who I am, I could be shot. Until y'all feel that, this ain't never gonna stop. Until you all that are not black feel us and stand with us, this is not going to stop.
We'll be right back.
The recent events in our country have created a grassroots effort to reallocate assets in a way that sustains and supports the African American community. Some are calling this movement Banking Black or Move Our Money. The experts say establishing credit is as critical as moving money. The U.S. Black Chambers and Liberty Bank have partnered to offer a credit card with a 9.9% interest rate. The U.S. Black Chambers and Liberty Bank working together in our community. For more information on the credit card, visit libertybank.net/affinity. Use promo code USBC.
Hey, Glenn.
Well, you can tell that Chip over there is getting ready for the old family vacation. Yeah. He's pulling out the boat, airing the tents, checking gear, getting everything packed.
Yeah, we're about to head out on our vacation, too.
But you're sitting here drinking tea, surveying your domain from that lawn chair.
Yeah, buddy.
So, are you really about to leave on a vacation?
Yep, right here in Arkansas to enjoy our great state parks.
Why aren't you getting your gear together?
Because we rent it in the state parks. Instant vacation. No hassles before we go and none after we get back.
Rent?
Yep, the state parks have ski boats, party barges, fishing boats, kayaks, canoes. They even have RVs and tents already set up, plus the cabins and more.
RVs?
Just go to ArkansasStateParks.com. It's all there.
Instant vacation sounds like a perfect vacation.
Yeah, it will be if you mow my lawn while I'm gone.
Well, sure.
Sponsored by this station, the Arkansas Broadcasters Association, and your Arkansas State Parks. My park, your park, our parks.
Your boat is a piece of junk.
Yeah, but they don't make them like this anymore.
Gee, I wonder why.
What?
You know, we could have rented a nice boat or a party barge right here at the park.
Huh? Rent?
Yeah, and your tent is moldy, too.
Moldy? What are you, the boat and tent police?
We could have stayed in one of the park yurts. You know, big, roomy tent already set up right on the lake.
Hmm.
Yeah, DeGray Lake Resort State Park has lots of things for rent.
Instant campsite, eh?
Why not? Or we could have stayed at the park. Lodge, enjoyed the restaurant, the heated pool.
Do I do anything right?
Well, yeah, you married my sister.
Now I remember why I let you in my boat.
So the next time we and the girls get together here at DeGray Lake Resort, you let me make the plans?
Plan away.
Well, if we ever get back to shore, I will. Online at DeGray.com.
Sponsored by this station, the Arkansas Broadcasters Association, and your Arkansas State Parks. My park, your park, our parks.
Okay, you guys, it's time to plan our vacation.
Okay, Mommy.
Okay.
This summer, we're gonna play in our own backyard.
We're staying home? No way.
In our yard? Really?
No, we're gonna play in Arkansas's backyard this summer. We're gonna visit our state parks.
All right.
Yeah.
Oh, count me in. I'll have less driving to do and more time to fish and golf, swim. Relax.
Uh-huh. So come here. Gather around. We're going to plan our vacation together.
For real?
Awesome.
Here we go. ArkansasStateParks.com. Ta-da! There, we're at the Arkansas State Parks website.
Ooh, look, I want to go there.
I want to do that.
Me too.
Just look at all there is to do. You know, playing in our own backyard in our state parks this summer is a great idea. Less travel time and more time for fun.
Sponsored by this station, the Arkansas Broadcasters Association, and your Arkansas State Parks.
Making vacation memories.
What are you doing Monday night? A lot of Americans are expected to watch the first presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Joining us now is our Washington contributor and our political contributor, Mundell Robinson. Mundell, you've heard the political pundit saying the viewership for the show, well, it will be a show, but for this debate will rival that of the Super Bowl. Surprised?
Not at all. I think we must remember that although both of these candidates have low approval ratings and people don't trust either of them, America has a high propensity or tendency to enjoy silliness. And that's what I'm thinking this debate is going to be full of, silliness, i.e. Donald Trump.
What does he need to do in Monday night's debate to solidify the support among the Republican base?
Well, I don't think there's a problem for his, he's not lacking support in the Republican base. That's a misnomer. He's actually basically solidified the Republican, which is disgusting in itself because his campaign is built off a couple of things. One, his five-year campaign to say that our president is an American. And then the second thing, it's built off the hate and talking about building a wall and making another country pay for it, mm-hmm. Which goes against their sovereignty. So that base is already solidified. The problem with the Republican Party and Donald Trump's candidacy is the Republican base is not large enough to win a national election. They can't win presidential elections with just a Republican base.
So what does he need to tell independents?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
What does he need to tell independents then, Monday night?
He it doesn't matter what Donald Trump does. He can't win this election, and I'll tell you why. This is a thing that's making me upset when I keep seeing all of the news stations talking about all of these polls and how close they are. Mm-hmm. If you look at the number of people they're polling and who they're polling 50 to 55 to 65-year-old white people. That's no longer the majority. That's no longer the way to tell what America's going to do as it pertains to the election. Donald Trump can win this election. Win this debate by a landslide and cannot win this presidency. You need the Obama coalition in order to win. The Obama coalition is 30% of white folk, which Hillary Clinton has, and then you need about 80 to 90% of the minorities. Hillary Clinton has that courtesy of Donald Trump. Because what he said about Latinos, mainly our Mexican brothers and sisters, what he said about the black communities, what he said about black communities, what he said about Muslims, has solidified his defeat in November.
So Monday night when Hillary shows up, what does she have to do in order to maintain her grip on the Obama coalition?
For me, I think she has to tell people that they can trust her. It seems that she gets in her way on a regular basis, providing ammunition for people to say, this is why we can't trust the Clintons. If it's not emails, it's her line about her health care. Mm. So if she just get out of her own way and let the story be Donald Trump talking, she can win this election with little work. But because her propensity to lie or withhold information, people don't trust her.
And what do you think is at the core of the secrecy?
If you spend 30, 40 years in the public eye, and the media has had their way with the Clintons. I'm not a huge fan of the Clintons, but the media has had its way with the Clintons. It tends to make you protect yourself or isolate yourself from certain information. So the public eye tends to do that.
Are you watching the debate?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to watch the debate. I'm watching it because I need to figure out a way to burn calories, and I figure if I'm throwing things at a TV, that's going to be a great way to do it. But beyond that, though, I'm watching people. Everybody's going to be watching to see what Donald Trump's going to say that's ridiculous. So the problem is we don't know which Donald Trump's going to show up. Is it going to be teleprompter Donald, or is it going to be Donald Trump that says any and everything?
Twitter Donald.
Donald Trump that will say anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That will say anything, and it doesn't matter. But here's going to be the star or the failure of the debate, the moderator. If the moderator doesn't fact check what candidates are saying and allow them to say anything, even though he knows it's false, then it ruins the debate. And I think it plays into the immaturity in which American politics has become.
And that's most likely an assist for Donald Trump.
It's a huge assist for Donald Trump. We know he has the propensity to lie every time he opens his mouth. I mean, every day there's a new lie from Donald Trump. He's saying that, you know, the latest lie was that he's watching Hillary Clinton steal his idea to have rallies on the runway in front of her airplane. And, you know, it's just ridiculous because all the way back to Roosevelt, presidential candidates have been holding presidential rallies in front of their airplanes.
They sure have.
And not excluding any president. And, you know, and then on top of that, you know, he'll say anything like Hillary Clinton used the Clinton Foundation for monetary gains when we know that the Clintons actually didn't make anything off of the Clinton Foundation. And he, on the other hand, has, to date, we know that he's spent $258,000 of the Trump Foundation money on his legal fees. Right?
So, you know, what is stunning is that a year ago, we talked about Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And we thought perhaps it would run its course. And here we are, a month or two, a couple months from the general election, and he is the Republican nominee.
He's the Republican nominee.
Unbelievable. Mondale Robinson, our political consultant and Washington, D.C. contributor. We'll see what happens Monday night.
We'll see. Good evening, Village.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
You know you need a little gospel to start your day.
I called in to talk about this girl, talking about she gonna sue because she didn't make the cheerleading squad.
You may have gotten a medallion for participation, but the trophies went to the winners.
Right. JC, we didn't get a medallion.
You know what we got?
What?
Thank y'all. Y'all be so good. Come in.
Turn us up.
Please, did you play basketball?
I play basketball. I got a picture of me.
JC Love Morning Show.
He's alive from the pitch of hell. That boy's not playing no basketball.
I did too.
Scotty, just because
you was a walking barber head.
JC, I got a request.
Yes, sir.
You need to cut it.
JC Love's Morning Show.
Alberta Faye Hires got her life back thanks to the Arkansas Tobacco Quit Line.
I smoked for 37 years, but with the support of my quit coach, I finally overcame my addiction. The Quit Line helped me set my own goals and turned a few steps into thousands. Now I run marathons. I'm stronger, healthier, and a positive role model for my grandchildren. I'm proud to say that I'm a quitter. You deserve to be proud of yourself, too. When you quit tobacco, you win.
Quit smoking or vaping. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Live tobacco and nicotine free.
Hey, business owners and entrepreneurs, our illustrious leader, J.C. Love, is so excited. He's put together a 5th anniversary advertising package just for your business. Me, personally, I think he's lost his ever-loving mind. Here's what you get.
JC
3 months of advertising. 3 times per day, Monday through Friday, and we throw in weekends just for kicks. We blast your business on the Joinet Radio social media network. Live mentions on the air. You get not one, not two, but 3 live interviews throughout the duration of the ad cycle. That's a $1,200 value. This total package is only $375. That's right, $375. Business owners, get to the phones right now. Call 855-525-5683 for the next 3 months. JoinEdRadio.com is celebrating its 5th year anniversary, and the savings are being passed on to you.
Do you have a minute? How about 30? Just 30 minutes a day of exercise could save your life. And it just might change your family's life, too. Just 30 minutes a day of the electric slide, the funky chicken, the mashed potato, or Zumba can boost your brain power and improve circulation. Just 30 minutes a day of hula hooping, playing tag, riding bikes, or nature walks can reduce stress and help improve your relationships, too. Just 30 minutes a day of basketball, jogging, playing double dutch, or jump rope can decrease your risk for all kinds of diseases, including stroke, diabetes, or heart disease. Doctors call it 30 minutes a day of exercise. Kids call it 30 minutes of playing. We call it 30 minutes of fun and making memories. Whatever you call it, let's move and make it a family affair. Choose a few fun activities to get your entire family moving. So drop the phone and give me 30. Drop the remote and give me 30. As Mama used to say, go outside and play. Brought to you by the Arkansas Minority Health Commission.
Imagine you've heard the name Madam C.J. Walker, but do you know Annie Malone? Not as familiar with Annie Malone. Well, she was the mentor for Madam C.J. Walker. Joining us now is Linda Nance, who is the founder of the Annie Malone Historical Society. Thank you so much for joining us, Linda.
Thank you for having me, Vicki.
So let's get the history record straight. Annie Malone really is the mother, if you will, of black hair care.
Absolutely. She's the pioneer of black hair care. She started walking, actually, throughout her community to introduce people of color, women of color, to hygiene and grooming of their hair. And that really was the thing that pushed the hair care. She taught women how to care for their hair. She had a philosophy that was a little bit different about beauty than most people. She felt that if you were clean and presented yourself in a manner that showed that you respected yourself, black women, black people would be more respected. She started a business in 1900. She started selling her preparations for the hair. As a young child, she would style her sister's hair, and after a while, she started styling neighbors' hair, and she started addressing some of the problems that they had. Black women, very early on, used goose grease and fat and lye on their hair.
Linda, goose grease? Goose grease. Is that, yes. Does that come from a goose?
Come from a goose.
Yeah, my goodness.
Okay. Absolutely. And it clogged the pores, and it caused all sorts of diseases of the scalp, which a lot of times left the hair leaving the scalp and damaging the scalp in such a fashion that it wouldn't grow back. So with her interest in chemistry and her ability to mix chemical compounds, she developed some treatments to the hair that would grow that hair back and heal that scalp. And she offered those to women. And that's what eventually became her poro system, to keep the hair clean, to keep the scalp clean. And it really took off like a wildfire.
Poro system. That's P-O-R-O. That's
P-O-R-O.
What she named her hair care system?
Yes, it was. It was, she trained women to provide hair care in such a fashion that it would keep the hair of women clean. It would style it in such a fashion that it was very attractive and people would get lots of compliments. And who doesn't love that?
And we love that, especially about our hair.
Who doesn't love that? That's right. You always want to present yourself in the best way possible. You're not always the most attractive person, but you can keep yourself clean and you can show respect for yourself, and that really does take your self-image a long way. What she did do at one point, she went to St. Louis. She started in Peoria, actually, and she moved to St. Louis to take advantage of the World's Fair. It was supposed to take place in 1902, and it did not. There were some difficulties with some of the buildings that they had, and they postponed it until 1904. And the World's Fair in St. Louis occurred in 1904. But in the meantime, Annie Malone took a trip south and was addressing lots of other African-American women. There was a good, large market there. And she did that same thing where she walked door-to-door to people and talked. And they said, you know, we're really busy ladies here. We have responsibilities. And if you just get us all together in one spot and talk to us, it would just be a lot better for everybody. Well, that revolutionized her way of marketing. And when she came back to St. Louis, she talked to all the black press and all the white press that would listen and basically said, I'm going to open a school and I'm going to train women to give this same idea to other women and improve African-American women all over everywhere.
Wow.
And the press basically said, yeah, right. That's what she said.
I'd like to see you do that, huh?
Well, she had two other buildings here in St. Louis at different times. And she decided she was going to keep her word and build an even bigger facility that was a neighborhood kind of entity. And when I say entity, I'm saying that this was something that belonged not only as a school for women and a manufacturing plant, but it was to be a community asset. And it was a place where people could have meetings and they could have concerts and they could have dinner or ice cream. It was a huge facility. And she set about training people of color, women of color, to do exactly that. She opened a huge school in 1918. She opened the Poro College. It was a college and a manufacturing center. It had a large auditorium that seated 500 people.
That's amazing.
It had an ice cream parlor, and it had a cafe. It had a beautiful rooftop garden where she advertised a way for you to have your cotillions and your graduations and your weddings and parties. It was just a beautiful building. People could have meetings in it. It was a real show place, a block long, cost about $1 million to build.
In 1918.
In 1918. With all the covenants that restricted where you could live in the St. Louis community. She built this building that was a show place, not only for St. Louis, but for the world, really.
Absolutely.
It was known throughout the United States. This was a showpiece of the African-American community. It had the best of anything you could have at that particular point. The elevators were the best elevators that were made.
In 1918.
in 1918. It was beautiful. It was absolutely beautiful. She was very interested in uplifting her race mm-hmm. of people. And she was at one point touted as a philanthropic zealot.
Wow. She believed in giving back to the community.
Absolutely.
And she had the fortune, evidently, to do so.
She sought out ways to help people. She helped with colleges. She helped give money to Howard University, their medical center. She donated $25,000 to that.
Back in the early 1900s. That is just unbelievable. Right. No one was really doing that in the African-American community at that time. Am I off base on that? Not really.
You're
not
right.
Not in large.
Not really.
And women at that.
Not as large a scale as she did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Don't misunderstand me. There were other women in the community.
Sure, okay.
In the United States who provided hair care. But Annie Malone and her sister Laura, started this enterprise, and they were very successful at it. Very successful. In fact, Madam C.J. Walker was one of their agents at one point.
That's what I was going to ask. How did their lives intersect?
Well, when Annie Malone came to St. Louis, not too long after that, I want to say 1905, 1906, Miss Davis was her name at that particular point.
Madam C.J. Walker's name was Miss Davis?
Her last name was Davis
okay.
at that point. And she was able to be employed by Annie Malone as one of her plural agents.
Okay.
And what she did was make sure that she covered a large territory. What she did is had territories of people to go and sell her product.
Mm-hmm.
And Madam C. John Walker was dispatched on several of those tours to go and sell in different places. One of the places where C.J. Walker, her name was Davis at that point, and married a Mr. Walker.
Okay.
She was distributing things in Colorado. Colorado Springs, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a big question as to whose products were who. She began to sell Poro products as her own products.
I see.
And there was some dissatisfaction with how that was going and what Madam C.J. Walker at that particular point. There's a question as to whether it was ethical or not.
Okay.
I don't know and have not had evidence to give me anything concrete.
I see.
I just have newspaper articles that I have read from African-American papers across the country at that particular point. But there's that question. And what Annie Malone did is decide I must patent these things and patent the Poro system so that it can be protected. And you find about that time different advertisements that say these are the Poro products, these are the Poro system products, and you have to be careful of imitation.
What's also interesting is that Annie Malone created an international business. Those Poro products were sold internationally.
Yes, it did, all over the world. Nova Scotia, Haiti, Canada, all over the world. She had representatives all over the world.
And she did not have a computer database. She didn't use social media. Linda, how did
no
she do
Twitter
all
account.
Of this? Right. How did she do all of that in the early 1900s?
Which is pretty remarkable, mm-hmm. if you ask me. I look at the dedication that she had to fund scholarships for two African-American students in every black land-grant college there was. I look at the fact that she contributed so much of her personal income to hospitals and to a personal charity of hers in St. Louis. The St. Louis Colored Orphans Home was her favorite, well, I'll say one of her favorite charities. She donated the first $10,000 to make that building so. It still operates today. Many people know about the Annie Malone Parade that occurs, and that parade still helps to fund that center that operates to this day.
That is an extraordinary legacy.
She is. She was a really powerful personality, but very demure, very quiet, very sincere in her wish to celebrate the good things in people. One of the fantastic things was the annual meetings that she would hold to congratulate her staff. She would give diamonds. She would give property.
Wow.
She would give stocks and bonds and encourage her agents to become a part of the community, be active in the community. There were Poro clubs that were established, and there have been students around the country who benefited as scholarships that came from those Poro clubs. She was a wonderful person to provide culture. One of the things that she did, a lot of people don't know, is dispatch across the country someone to video and film, I should say film, the wonderful things that African Americans were capable of doing.
Really?
And she would come back to St. Louis and show them at clubs and show them at church. She wanted to make it possible for people to know you can do anything you put your mind to.
What a beautiful spirit and an amazing American.
Yes, absolutely.
Annie Malone.
To revitalize that story is very important to me.
Okay. And if we'd like more information about Annie Malone, Linda, where do we go?
You go to AnnieMaloneHistoricalSociety.org. That's the website. Gives you a lot more information about her and gets you much more revved up than I could possibly do.
Well, you've done a great job of revving us up, so we'll visit the website. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're listening to the Village Celebration Podcast. The contents of this broadcast are the exclusive property of the Village Celebration. Any duplication, rebroadcast, or any other use is strictly prohibited, and it is not permitted without the express written consent of the Village Celebration.